This podcast is part of the Podcast Arcade Network.
Welcome to the Covert Nerd Podcast. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. Please take a moment and pause this podcast right now and share it with somebody who you would think would enjoy the same topic, whether it's a family member, friend, coworker. I would really appreciate it. Please go to covertnerd.net for all the previous episodes and the different ways that you can get in touch with me. And without further ado, let's dive right in and nerd it up. All right, everybody, we've got a fun new episode or series of episodes where we'll be talking about early 90s comics. And I've got some great guests to talk about early 90s comics because we're all in that age category. I've got Al and Ben of Omug Comics. So thanks, guys, for hopping on the podcast and reminiscing about old comics.
Thanks, Lee.
No worries.
This is a topic that I know a lot of us in our age category loved because we all had a lot of these early comics in the early 90s because the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, the comics were selling like crazy. I pulled up some stats. So here's some stats from 2021. So the number one selling comic, according to Statista, was issue number 4 of Star Wars of the Bounty Hunters, sold 149,000 comics last year. But if you go and look at 1992, for example, Superman, The Death of Superman, Superman Volume 2, number 75, sold 6.8 million copies of just one issue. So that's just how huge comics were in the early 90s, guys, right?
Yeah. Right. I was going to say, when you threw out that 149,000 mark, I was like, that seems really low. But apparently I'm just still stuck in the early 90s when it comes to comic sales.
Now, I should clarify, that was just physical copies. We have obviously digital copies now, but still.
Right.
I mean, that's a massive, massive difference between now
and then. Right. You went from 6 million to just a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah. Yeah. And like we were talking about a little bit earlier, there was, you know, X-Men number 1, 8.2 million, I think it was. Spawn number 1 in 1992 sold 1.7 million copies. So again, all the top 10 comics in say 1992 were more than probably all the comics sold in 2020, 2021, easily.
Easily.
Wow. Easily.
That's insane.
But it was such a glut, and I'm sure we'll get into it eventually. The bubble did have to burst, but we'll go through these and just the list of talent that we have on some of these is just amazing. The way it's going to work is each of us will pick two comics. We'll just talk about them, reminisce about them, and you know a lot of these are still available. You can go get them, and definitely if you haven't seen some of these or read any of these, I encourage everybody to go check it out. This is some of where comics today even got influenced by a lot of these artists and writers and things like that. So Al, let's start with you. What was your first early 90s pick that you wanted to talk about?
So I went with Spider-Man number 1. This was the adjectiveless Spider-Man. I think it's perfect to start here because this was the book that defined 90s comics and launched the comic bubble revolution. This thing, I came across this because Todd McFarlane was on my radar. You know, I'd been collecting comics for 2 years and reading comics for a couple years. And so, you know, and it was always Marvel. And so by default, I knew who Todd McFarlane was. And picking up a copy of Wizard here and there, I knew that this book was coming out. And,
oh, okay. So you saw it in Wizard first.
Yeah. I mean, well, there was talk of, you know, McFarlane was going to be doing this and Eric Larson had taken over Amazing Spider-Man. And so when this came out, I found this at the local grocery store back when they still had comics.
Spinner rack?
Yeah. And I snagged as many copies as I could. I still have the one that's in the bag, that's in the original poly bag.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And then, you know, it just blew up, you know, and looking back at different stuff, you know, this is the one that it sold. This came out in.
Yeah. What year was this? 1990?
August of 1990.
Okay.
And it sold 2.35 million copies.
Wow.
Now, this was the one where speculators got involved because this took off and because it was bagged. Like, there's even videos of like Donald Trump buying copies of this book.
Really?
Yeah, Wall Street was saying, hey, we're going to, you know, this is going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And what they did was, you know, of course, they destroyed the market.
Oh, yeah.
And it just ruined the value.
So it's kind of like you said, this is where the speculation kind of got started.
Yeah. Well, and it was also, you know, the numbers are impressive, you know, the 2.35 million copies, you know, like Amazing Spider-Man, Uncanny X-Men, books like that at the time were doing a couple hundred thousand a month. Those were the big boys. Otherwise, on average, you know, probably 50, 60,000 for the average comic every month.
Yeah.
So this thing really was huge, but at the same time, it's also partially inflated because of the polybag. You know, people didn't want to open it. They sold it as, this is going to be a collector's item. You want to hang on to this. So everybody was buying two of them.
Yep.
And then they came out with the different colored covers that also factored in with sales. You had the gold cover, the silver cover.
Yep.
So, you
know, my brother has all of those.
Right.
Oh, okay. Yep.
The numbers aren't honest is ultimately the point. But either way, when I first got it, I was a huge McFarlane fan. And the art blew me away. And I probably drew every image from this book, either tracing it or just, you know, trying to copy it as much as I could.
Oh, okay. So is this what kind of got you into art, maybe?
Oh, comic books definitely did. Yeah.
I mean, Spider-Man in particular? Or...
No, I was already into art.
Okay.
Before this, but I mean, this certainly, you know, helped encourage and egg me on.
I guess, what was McFarlane drawn before this? I don't remember exactly.
He was on Amazing Spider-Man.
Okay.
Before, he'd also done, you know, he'd done some, like, he popped up in like X-Men Annual here and there and like done some pinup work.
Okay.
There was the run on the Hulk that he did with that iconic cover of, you know, Wolverine's claws.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With the reflection in the Hulk in the claws.
Yeah. And he did the Gray Hulk run. So, nice. Yeah. And at the time, like I said, this blew me away. Going back and looking at it now, with my modern eyes, it's not as impressive.
That's what I was wondering. What now?
the art is still dynamic. You know, like that image that you have there with Spider-Man hanging from the web, lurking in the corner over the bad guy. That's a great visual, and it's really fun, and it's very dynamic. You know, one thing that can be said about all the image guys is that all of their work is very dynamic. They fill the page. They've got that big money shot, so to speak, on every page. You know, like in this particular book, Todd McFarlane's probably not the best writer.
Yeah.
his dialogue isn't the best. It's, you know, it's kind of corny. It's very simple. And reading it now, it's like, yeah, all right. Because
he was the artist and, yeah, you're right. He was the artist and the writer. Okay.
Yeah. This was his baby. This was his project. In fact, this book is what, if it weren't for this book, Image probably wouldn't have existed.
Yeah. This is, McFarlane was, this Spider-Man run was huge. I collected a little bit of Spider-Man, so I'm not as quite as in tune as maybe you are, but iconic cover, and Todd McFarlane definitely cut his teeth on Spider-Man.
Yeah, he made a name for himself. Yeah, the writing in this book, it's not great, but they did, you know, nobody was buying this for Todd McFarlane's words.
Yeah, no, that was the art.
Right. This was clearly for the art, and this is what I think got a lot of people into Todd McFarlane. Just in general, which then, you know, as he went on and did other things, people were just, I'm a fan of Todd McFarlane. I don't care what he's drawing. And it's probably because of stuff like this.
Spider-Man. Absolutely. Oh, yeah, by far. He has, all of them have a style, but his is pretty definitive. You can definitely tell his style. It's his use of color, and then you can see, like, the webbing is a lack of a better word, stringy. You know, he has that look to it.
There's a lot of noodling with his
work. You go, noodling.
There's a lot of extra lines and hashes, and, you know, at first glance it looks really detailed, and in a lot of ways it is, but then in other ways there's a lot of unnecessary marks that just are there to just add more blacks and fill things up, and it works. He does a really good job. I'm not knocking it. I mean, obviously he figured out the formula.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and this is an example, as you're saying that, looking at the picture, like when you look at Spider-Man's leg, that thigh, it's indicative of the 90s, where there's muscles on muscles, and muscles that don't exist are all of a sudden magically there.
Yes.
And so you look at that thigh and you're like, that shouldn't be like that.
Yeah. And McFarlane will be the first one to tell you that he was never good at anatomy. He just knew how to make it look good. There's certainly a couple pages in this, a couple of scenes where Peter Parker and Mary Jane are talking. You have a shirtless Peter Parker and you can tell the anatomy gets a little strange and challenged.
It's just 90s anatomy.
Yeah.
You hit it. We started early 90s with a little bit of muscle. By 95, we're like muscles on muscles on muscles. It just got worse and worse.
Right. Like I said, they just started inventing muscles because, like Al said, there's a blank spot on their page. So they're like, oh, I guess another bicep can go there.
Let's put some more biceps. I got a fever and the cure is more biceps. Oh, man. But yeah. Still, even going back, it's now obviously we got a little bit of nostalgia, Al, but going back, it's still, what was your impression compared to maybe 30 years ago when you saw it on the spinner rack?
It's still fun. It's still very dynamic. Like I can, I can look at it and totally see why, my 12-year-old brain immediately clung onto it. Cause it is like, it grabs you.
Yeah.
Like I said, looking now, knowing what I know now, I'm like, that's not how lats work, but ultimately that's a silly point. And like I said, the story's not great. The writing isn't fantastic, but it gets the job done. It's good enough. And it is, it's a lot of fun. And I can totally see, even if people didn't take it out of the bag, the cover is amazing.
Sure. Sure.
But if you did take it out of the bag and you did bother to read it, it is, you're going to definitely want to pick up the second issue and keep going with it.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Good story. Rant Todd did Spider-Man, I think until 92 or 93 before he moved over to, I think it was 92 before he moved over to Image, but he had a good run there.
Well, this was his run. So this, he did this up through issue 16, I believe.
16, okay.
Makes sense. Because it was, even on the, I think it was the cover of 16, it was the sideways issue. And it, Spider-Man is even saying, bye, Todd.
Ah, okay. Nice.
And then Eric Larson came in on this and did a couple of issues. And this, when he left this, that's when he started working on Spawn.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And so it was 91. So this was 90, say 91, 90 is when they were all working on their Image stuff. And 92 is when they started dropping them. So,
yep. Okay. No, it's a good, like I said, just looking at it now, it's just very well drawn. I mean, it looks excellent. So, but Todd was known for his artist, not for his artistry work, not necessarily his dialogue.
Right.
So
much the fact that I didn't even know he wrote stuff. I thought he was just an artist.
I know. That's when Al said he wrote this. I'm like, are you sure he wrote this?
he wrote the first few issues of Spawn and got it plotted. And then after that, he famously, handed the reins of Spawn off to everybody else and paid exorbitant sums of money to do it because he knew that his writing wasn't that good.
He's good at starting. At least he knows. Finishing. Yeah. He knows his limits, I guess.
Yep.
All right. Well, Ben, what's your first pick for us?
Since we kind of teased it, talking about McFarlane going over to Image, I don't have any images. This is funny. This book, I thought I still had a copy of it, but I don't. And I scoured Omaha looking for a copy of this, but nobody had it because as Al pointed out, none of the comic shops will pay any money for these because there's a billion of them in the world. So my first choice is Newman by Image Comics. It was released in 1994, I think, is when the first one came out. Also, speaking of horrible anatomy, it was created or co-created by Rob Liefeld.
Yeah,
it's part of his Extreme Studios, which was, I guess, kind of like an offshoot of Image or within Image. He didn't do a whole lot of work on it, actually, from what I found out later on. He's credited as a creator, but he did just like some stuff on the first issue. And then, much like Todd McFarlane, went, no, you guys keep making my stuff and I'll just cash the paychecks.
Yep.
I got into this because it's always been my, I guess, my MO of comics, sometimes music and movies and stuff. If everybody is into something and think it's really cool, then I want to go and find something different.
Yep.
So then I'm not just part of the mainstream. So everybody was into X-Men. Everybody was into Marvel. And I said, I'm going to find something different.
Yep.
And I'm going to go to Image and this new book here called Newman, because, you know, Newman, X-Men, completely different.
Yes.
Nothing derivative at all.
No, I mean, not at all. I mean, in Newman, they are what they call new gene positive individuals. They're not mutants.
Oh, okay.
The new gene also explains the presence of mythological creatures in this world, like werewolves and things like that. And to not be too derivative or just make it like a default, they also later on explained that the new gene was genetic tampering that aliens had done on human beings as a way to make certain people stronger and to cull out the weak. And eventually these aliens, which are called the Keep, are going to come back and harvest all these stronger people to, I don't know, work in their mines or whatever. So again, completely not derivative. The main characters in this book, or the initial characters, was a guy named Rain, and he's the one on this page. He's in the bottom left. He's got the gem in his forehead.
Yep.
He is a telepath and a telekinetic, so not Jean Grey or Professor X. He can also shoot psychic blasts, which are not at all the same as Cyclops' blasts.
Not at all.
So we have Rain, and then we have Bird, who can fly. No, he does not fly like an angel at all. That's why his name is Bird.
Bird. Oh, okay. Big difference.
he eventually like evolved into like almost an actual bird. Like he started off with just wings under his arms.
Yeah.
But then like he eventually sprouts like talons and actual wings and a beak. It got really stupid. They have a person who's really fast, which creatively they named Dash. And then my favorite character out of this, his name is Exit, and he could teleport through another dimension, not at all like Nightcrawler. So what he did actually, though, and the reason I liked him, because he was, again, different from Nightcrawler, is his teleporting, he would like throw out and he could control the size of like basically what looked like black holes.
Yeah.
And then he would step through them, which would take him through this other dimension, and then he'd come out the other side wherever he wanted to be. So, you know, like I said, completely different and original, not X-Men at all. And that's what drew me in, is that it was original and new, and nobody else was doing anything like this at all, ever, since, like, you know. But much like Al, when I first, I mean, that was the main reason I got into it, because I really was like, oh, I'm doing something different. And I didn't pick up on all those similarities and derivativeness, which I don't think is a real word.
It is now.
Kind of like Al, you know, with the artwork of that Spider-Man. When I read this book, it was new. It was original. Mm-hmm. But, you know, looking back later as I got older, I went, oh, this is just Image's version of X-Men.
Yeah.
Okay. And even when you read anything online about it, they even make jokes about how, like I was just doing, like, you know, unlike X-Men, they did this, and it's like, ugh, it's horrible. But the colors and the big, you know, big bold action sequences that Image and Liefeld in general, you know, are known for is what really drew me into it. It seemed like with this book, they really like the color saturation, I guess the best way to put it, like they just crammed a bunch of color into it, and that made it, for me, it looked awesome. It looked different. And so it just, like Al, you know, when I was younger, it sucked me right in with the bright flashing colors. And I was hooked through all the issues that I ever bought. Oh, I forgot one character who, again, 100% original.
Kodiak. Yeah.
And he's a guy who can transform into a big beast-like character, but he is not Beast. He's Kodiak.
Kodiak. Yeah.
And what's great about this is that character is, in true, you know, 90s American fashion, he's supposed to be a Native American, but if you ever see any of the drawings of him when he's in his human form, he is whiter than I am. But they gave him a name like Nathaniel Running Cloud or some crap like that. You know, he was probably a linebacker for the Redskins or something, but it was really bad. But no, but like I said, just that the, in my eyes, it was something different. And, you know, my brother and his friends, you know, impacted a lot of the stuff that I was into, mainly just getting into comics. But again, like, I didn't want to seem like I was copying them. So, well, my brother's into Spider-Man and his, one of his really good friends was into X-Men and another one, a huge DC guy. So I'm just like, oh, well, screw you. I'm going independent with Image and completely different. So
that's awesome.
But again, looking back now, you know, 15, 20 years later, it's like, oh, that wasn't different at all. It's like I said, they didn't even try very hard with camouflaging the name. Instead of X-Men, it's Newman.
That's the on issue number one, the basketball scene where they're playing basketball with each other. There's an X-Men issue that has the exact same thing, same premise. They're playing basketball at the Xavier School. Yeah, it's almost frame for frame the exact same thing.
Well, and the shot that you have on screen now of the villain on the right, you know, you're kind of looking over his shoulder and everybody's doing their dramatic poses. That was done a few times by Jim Lee in X-Men books.
Yep.
And the fun thing about the Extreme books is they had a license to print money. So Extreme Studios was Liefeld's, it was his personal studio. It was his company.
Yep.
Right.
And he would pay these guys like $5,000 a book to ink it in 1991. Yeah. Like these guys were rolling up in Ferraris and stuff as the inker and penciler of these books. It was insane. And they had the formula. They had the brand spanking new digital coloring and the glossy paper, and it looked amazing. And they knew what poses, and it was all just a formula. And anything that said Image at that time, man, people were buying them up in droves. And so, I totally see why little Ben would get hooked on this.
Yeah.
Right. It's funny that you bring up that, you know, like the Extreme Studios was just Liefeld kind of playing around. As I was doing some research and taking notes on this, because like I said, I couldn't find my actual copy of the book.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you still have this, but
there might be a long box at my parents' house that contains it, but I don't have it with me here in Nebraska. But they're talking about a lot of the Extreme Studios and Image to launch things. They would do miniseries, like a 4 or 5 issue run just to see what it would do. And this, of course, was one of those. And funny is there's a line that it's talking about this one, and I can't remember what the other series is, but it says both miniseries kept a much better schedule for Extreme Comics titles. And it said this could be attributed to the minimal role that Rob Liefeld played in the production of the series.
Yes, because anything he touched was notoriously late.
Right. So he literally, like I said, he helped come up with this, and then he got who did he get to do this? Eric Stevenson and Chris Sprouse and Al Gordon did writing, penciling, and inks respectively.
Yeah.
Some of the character design was also done by Jeff Matsuda, but Liefeld basically like created this. And then like Al said, just went, all right, now you six guys draw it. When the check comes in, you'll get your cut. So,
They basically just put their names on this stuff and it just sold like wildfire. It didn't really matter what it was. It would sell, you know, Newman probably sold several hundred thousand issues without even, just because it had Rob Liefeld's name on it and the Image logo.
Right. Yeah. Like Al said, you know, in the early 90s or most of the 90s, you just put that Image logo in the top left-hand corner and you're going to sell a few hundred thousand books.
Yep.
And then coupled with, like you said, Rob Liefeld and even Matsuda, who, when it comes to comics, I don't know, like, you know, Al can rattle off artists and writers and all this stuff. I know who Rob Liefeld is, and I know the name Jeff Matsuda. So my guess is even today, if you said, hey, there's a new book and Liefeld and Matsuda are working on it, I'd go, I'll check it out.
The best thing about Extreme Studios is it was a great breeding ground because you had all these guys that, you know, were just at the right age.
Yeah.
At the right time that, you know, it was before the floodgates really opened, you know, because that as a result of the early 90s comic boom, everybody and their mother wanted to become a comic book artist, myself included.
Yep.
And so the competition just became just ridiculous and just almost impossible. Yeah. These guys that were here at this moment, where you talk about the right place at the right time. And, you know, you can look at this, you can tell, like, there's a reason that Jeff Matsuda didn't get hired on at Marvel or DC. He wasn't there yet, but he was good enough for Extreme Studios, where you slap the right inker with him and get the fancy cards, and it's good enough. Because you mentioned Al Gordon. Al Gordon is an inker. He's been around forever.
Oh, okay.
And he'd worked with Marvel. He'd worked with DC. I mean, he's a mercenary. Chris Sprouse is the same thing. Chris Sprouse is like a lot like Matsuda. He went on to do bigger and better things and is still around in the industry. But a lot of these guys, it was a breeding ground, and they cut their teeth and they actually went on to do like notable good work, and they evolved and improved from this.
Yeah. But they got their start here, you know, making these insane characters, and there again, you just look at the coloring and just the layout. It's just no wonder kids, you know, 10 to or 8 to 14, 15, 16 loved it. It's totally different as far as just how the colors, how they did it. I don't know why, but it looked different than what you were seeing at Marvel or DC. So, all
right. Right. Like I said, it's like they just like somehow packed more color onto the page than anyone else could.
Well, it was they more abs. Could because of the glossy paper, whereas Marvel and DC were still using newsprint. Image was able to spend had more money to spend from the initial launches, but they also weren't printing as many books as Marvel and DC, because Marvel and DC, you know, had 85 books each month that were going out, a few hundred thousand each, so they couldn't afford to do the glossy paper, whereas these guys easily could right off the bat. So,
yep,
and they would look better with the digital coloring. So they literally did pack more color into the page.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Well, we're sticking with the Image theme here. Young Blood by Rob Liefeld, again, another Extreme Studios production, and just segueing off of what Al said, the bullpen for Image was just massive. If you look here, I'm going to find it. The Image founders here, Eric Larson, Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld, Todd McFarlane, Willis, I always slaughter his name, Portasia, Mark Silvestri, Jim Valentino. So those are the founders, but shortly after that, Sam Keith, Dale Keown. I mean, just those names, just Marvel had a slew of talent there in the late 80s, early 90s that moved over to Image. And those names, I mean, anybody who was reading comics at that time knows exactly who and what their titles were, what they were writing and drawing at that time. So.
Yeah, it was a murderer's row, and they really screwed up by letting these guys go.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They did. The bottom line, but we got stuff like Young Blood and just Image in general. And like Al said, for me, this is one of the first independent comic books I bought. And it had, you know, again, it was kind of a marketer's dream. You had the glossy paper. You didn't have the newsprint paper like Marvel had. You didn't have any ads in the comic book. And it was just very, very, like I said, very well colored. One of the first digital coloring comics that were out there. Malibu, I think, is the one that did a lot of the electronic coloring, which, again, doesn't sound like a big deal, but you could tell. You could stick Young Blood next to an X-Men comic and flip through it, and you could just see the difference. Nowadays, we're like, what? Everything's always glossy paper, and it's always been that way. In fact, I saw that. Some, as a gimmick, some independent publishers were purposely publishing on the newsprint paper again just to have something different. So 30 years later, we've kind of come full circle. This having glossy paper was a niche back in 1990, you know, 1, 2, and 3. Now having newsprint paper is a niche. It's something different. Young Blood, obviously, you can see. Pretty much an X-Men knockoff. I mean, it's very obvious. But iconic cover, sold millions upon millions of issues, like we said. Got the six members of the team I'm sorry, five. Well, six. Bad Bedrock, which Rob Liefeld got in trouble because of the Flintstones. He couldn't use that name anymore, so they changed it to Bad Rock. You got Combat, Chapel, Vogue, Die Hard, and Shaft. Shaft's the basically Scott Summers of the team. They're more like the Avengers in the fact that they're government hired and they all have their little niche, their little gimmick that they have. Came out in April of 92, and they actually first appeared in the Megaton comic. Let me see if I can find in 1987. So yeah, here's, and I'll put it in the show notes. Here's the of the original, what they kind of looked like in the Megaton comic that Liefeld came up with back in 1987. So you can see they have their kind of their Wolverine guy, kind of their strong man, the girl, the eye candy, whatever, lack of a better word. Yep. But and it is Rob Liefeld, and you guys can all see the mouth. He is notorious for grunting or whatever. I don't know why he likes to do that, but yeah. And he did draw feet. Every once in a while, he did draw feet. The running joke is that he can't draw feet.
But I say there's no way that's Liefeld. There's too many feet and hands.
I know. I just noticed that. It's like some of these, they actually have some feet on there and no pouches. Well, at least not on the first few pages. They have right. Some pouches.
Right.
So, but still a fun, I mean, again, like Ben was saying, they're very colorful and the layouts and, oh, here we go. All right, guys. Al and Ben, you need to sign up to be in the Rob Liefeld fan club. So,
of course.
There's no,
I may have actually done that.
Says, yes, I want to join the Rob Liefeld fan club. Enclosed is $3.50 plus $1 postage and handling. You'll get quarterly newsletter featuring up-to-the-minute news on Liefeld-related products, original artwork, convention appearances, and an open forum for Rob Liefeld fans. And yeah. An exclusive button and mini poster.
Just literally handing him your cash.
Awesome. And what such a like early 90s like ego move. Like, it's not join the Image fan club or join this comic book fan club. It's Rob Liefeld fan club.
Yep.
Yes.
Like, screw the rest of the guys that I work with. You're in my fan club.
Hey, but that was Image, right? Every man for himself.
Yeah. Well, it's about independent comics.
You're right.
That was the whole reason they went there, so they could do their own thing. But yeah, isn't this just obviously a money ploy? But just, I saw this, I'm like, oh, I got to bring this up.
Yeah, that's funny.
I feel like that's going in the next money book.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to see the Al Garrison fan club.
Join the Al Garrison fan club.
Oh,
yeah, I'll make sure to reach out. I can reach out to both members individually every month.
Send us $3 and we'll give you some of Al's beard hair.
Yes.
Yes. Al, you need to do like a parody of this, like the Lenny Vernon fan club or something.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's going to be an issue 12.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. But yeah,
you wouldn't have to try too hard to reach out to. You wouldn't have to try too hard to reach out to all two members because, you know, one of them would be me and the other one would probably be Kim. So.
No, it'll be Eddie. My wife's not going to be in this club.
She won't join.
That's true. Eddie. Yeah,
she won't join.
She's too frugal with her money. She's not going to join.
It's like, what? I get a button, but you get a button.
She knows a scam when she sees it.
And right. A mini poster.
She's the one making the buttons.
Yeah, she's right. Yeah, have her make the buttons. Right. Oh, man.
She's making the Al Garrison fan club t-shirts. Oh, yeah, keep one of those for yourself because you're a member.
You're a member now. Yeah, I think I saw this at a local comic book shop in the small town I was living in. I was like, this is just totally different. They don't have the Comics Code Authority, so they don't have to follow those guidelines. You can have blood, you can swear, they don't have any background, you know, there's no back history, so they kind of just do whatever they want. And
or perspective, according to that picture that you have on screen.
Yes, you could just all just like, I think you said they just knew how to pose things. So when they do these double page spreads, they just knew how to grab a kid's attention. Like, this just looks totally awesome.
It's all just coming right at you, all dynamic. You know, it could be an image of a guy grabbing a loaf of bread off a store shelf, and yes. It's the most amazing, exciting right. thing ever.
Muscles, and they're still grinding like coming their teeth. Yeah,
right. The motion lines.
You notice, like on this page, Shaft has two arrows in his bow. You know, we're not messing around with one; we're doing two.
Right, and he's of course the classic marksman where he could take anything at any distance and, you know, deadly accurate.
Oh yeah, like in this issue, he kills a guy by throwing a pin at him. That's how good he is.
One might say that he's got a Hawkeye.
Right? Yeah. You think? Not copying anybody.
If I remember right,
no.
Youngblood, like their whole shtick was essentially they were the X-Men, but they were going to be famous for it.
Yes.
And they were going to get paid for it, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, they're not secret like the X-Men. They're hired by the government, but they're also doing endorsements. They're doing movies. They're basically Hollywood actors, but they also fight crime and stop terrorists and alien invasions and all sorts of things.
Gotcha.
So that's essentially what
they were. That is an original take on that type of story, though, because up until then, like you said, his X-Men were secretive. Nobody knew who they were, or at least didn't know their secret identities. You know, yep. Avengers, yes and no, kind of knew who they were. Yep. So the fact that these guys just, you know, this team just flat out, oh, no, we're getting paid for this. We're going to be famous. That's that itself is kind of an original idea and kind of cool.
Yeah.
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 And I was here for it, man. I was hooked on Youngblood from the start.
Yeah, they sold millions of issues, and I loved every – I had probably the issues 1 through 15 or 16, whatever they went up to. They had Team Youngblood. Mm-hmm. They had several other spinoffs. I bought all of those. Youngblood Strike File. Yeah, they had one – yeah. I think the Strike File had, like, the cutouts of their cars and their weapons and kind of told how they did all this stuff. Bought them all. I was right there buying everything, even though I knew it was probably gimmicked, but I didn't care. It was all cool.
Yeah, and if I remember right, as a series, it went off the rails pretty quick.
It did. See, he did just like what he did with Newman. He wrote, Liefeld wrote and drew the first, you know, 5, 6, 7 issues, and then it just went, handed the reins off to somebody else. And what they found, when I was doing a little research on Image Comics, I think the reason, part of the reason it was, is they were artists and writers, but they weren't businessmen. And they found out real quick that there's a lot of business aspects to doing this. And so I think they had to maybe do some of the business stuff and not so much of the art. And that's what
there was that. Plus there was also, because it blew up and became as big as it did.
Yeah.
They were also getting pulled in 15 different directions to start doing a lot more media. You know, getting paid stupid amounts of money to fly across the country and do different cons and different events and signing events. And if you're doing that, you're not working, you know, but there's different stories that I've read and seen where they would be on an airplane with their, you know, with a board and they're drawing their page on there and they're inking and drawing in flight, you know, because that's what they had to do in order to try and meet deadlines, which ultimately I think, maybe Snow Spawn. I think Savage Dragon was probably the only one that never missed a deadline. Everybody else just they all fell victim to the deadlines.
Youngblood constantly. There's one of our other picks that we'll get to is even more notorious for being late. But yeah, I did read a story out just like that. They were, I think it was Liefeld and Jim Lee, maybe Todd McFarlane, I can't remember. They got on a plane in New York because they finished up a con at, I think, 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and we're flying virtually all night to get to LA to do some sort of event in the morning at like 8 or 9 in the morning, and basically just drew and working on business almost all night long on that flight. So yeah, it was just insane, but they were just selling, I mean, millions and millions and millions of issues of every single thing they put out. I think I agree with you, Al. I don't think they knew how big it was going to be.
No, I don't think they knew it was going to be big. They knew that they had the name, the recognition because of the sales of their other books, you know, with X-Men was huge. X-Force was huge. You know, go down the list and all of them had big numbers except for Jim Valentino. but, you know, they knew they had something, but I don't think estimated exactly how big, because even after missing all the deadlines and the work getting subpar, they were still selling just stupid numbers.
Yeah.
The stores and the distributors didn't give up on them yet.
No. If you sold, if for them, an issue selling maybe 300,000 to 400,000 was a low month. And now, if you sold 300,000 to 400,000 issues now, that would be huge.
You're the biggest comic in the world, and you're immediately getting a Hollywood deal.
Yeah. no joke. All right. Well, that's enough Youngblood. Youngblood, good comic. But I guess my take on it, going back to it, it was very, and all of them were that way back then, a lot more wordy, for lack of a better word, wordy, a lot of word bubbles. But obviously I'm jaded by nostalgia, so I thought it was still okay, but it just definitely, it's definitely showing its age.
Yeah, it doesn't really.
Well, that's what's great about all these books. I mean, even though, like I said, I couldn't go back and reread Newman because I can't find it. But I think today I would sit down and read it. And while I could point out all of its flaws, I'd still be like, I like this book.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, you know.
it's still fun to go back and revisit it. But it's just different, I guess. But, you know, it's also been 30 years.
Right.
All right. So, Al, what's your next one?
My next book is X Factor. Number 71.
Okay.
So this book, I was actually a subscriber to X Factor at this time, because I originally started off with X-Men. I had my Uncanny X-Men subscription. And then, of course, I needed all things X-Men. And so I got X Factor.
Yeah.
And leading up to this, it was X Factor was the original team. Prior to this issue, it was the original X-Men team. So it was, you know, Cyclops, Jean Grey, Iceman, Beast, Angel. And the original concept of X-Factor was that they were subversive. They weren't coming out and saying that they're mutants, and they would go around and scoop up mutants under the pretense that if, you know, somebody found a mutant, we don't like mutants, X-Factor comes in, they take them, and then you never see them again. But they were just recruiting for Professor X and getting, you know, these people to safety and whatnot. And then everything, you know, just kind of the whole X world was kind of blowing up at the time, and it was huge. Yep. And it was the biggest book that Marvel had. And it just, they were going to come out with X-Men number one, and they wanted, you know, they wanted these characters in X-Men. And they also wanted the characters in Uncanny X-Men. And so they wanted to keep X-Factor going. And I think they came up with this really clever idea of getting, you know, the all new, all different. And they brought back like all of these forgotten characters. And this became like the, like almost like the land of misfit toys.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was so great about this book when it became this is this felt, you know, as a kid, Spider-Man was around for 30 years before I started reading. Superman was around, and X-Men was around, and they were all established. And this was, you know, really all new and all different. And these characters that, yeah, you'd seen them in other books here and there, but they didn't have any kind of presence. So you felt like you were here at the start of something new.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so in this book, in this particular story, they're just rounding up the team and getting all these characters together. So you've got Havoc, who the last time we saw Havoc was in Genosha with the Extinction Agenda.
Oh yeah. Great story arc, by the way.
Yeah. And, same with Ran or Rain, however you say her name, the Wolfsbane, formerly of the New Mutants. She was in Genosha. And then you've got, Guido.
Yep.
And the only, who's this, just this giant behemoth.
Yes.
Who's just always goofy. And the only time that I'd ever seen him prior to this is he was Dazzler's bodyguard.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I don't know anything about him, though, other than that. Yeah, it's Dazzler's bodyguard.
That was it. Yeah. Just Dazzler's bodyguard. I didn't even realize he was a mutant. I just figured he was just, you know, weirdly drawn. Guy. And just, yeah, he's just huge.
Yes.
and then you had, you know, Lorna Dane there, Polaris, who was the Jean Grey to Havoc, essentially. And then Jamie Madrox, the multiple man, who I'd never seen before, Although in the issues, I went back and looked, and the issues leading up to this, they started introducing all of these people because I think even they realized nobody knows who these guys are. The kids reading this now don't know these characters from 5-6 years ago. So
yeah,
that we only had in there once. And so this issue, like I said, issues before, they kind of brought him back a little bit. And then this is just introducing you, and it's kind of a goofy story. I reread it, and it's not a great story as they're introducing you to everybody. And like they have this stupid mayonnaise jar that nobody can open
bit. Yes.
Goes throughout just that. As like a way to help show off. Because, you know, this is an origin issue, so you have to show everybody's powers.
Yeah.
And so
you have to find a clever way to showcase their powers, yeah.
Except they didn't find a clever way. They had the stupid mayonnaise jar bit. And so, like, Polaris, use her magnetic power, and Havoc can blast it, and, you know.
Strong guy is strong. You know, he can.
I say, did Guido just, like, turn it? It's like, I don't know. That was
no.
easy.
No, nobody opens it except until the end, and Val Cooper ends up opening it. So what they're doing here is they're getting this team together because, like I said, they had to take all the other X characters and give them back
the
X-Men. It was just a brief little cameo. So they're putting this team together because of Genosha and the Extinction Agenda and other events in the X-Men world. Mutants are obviously not wildly popular, and the government wants to put together this team as like a government-funded public relations strike team. So these guys are going to be like Delta Force. Anytime, anywhere around the world where there's anything involving mutants, X-Factor is going to go in. They're going to clean it up and give mutants a good face, keep everything cool, while also working directly for the government. And so you've got Val Cooper, the blonde woman back there, who's the government liaison, and she's kind of shady from the start. And
of course,
yeah. And at the end of this issue, Jamie Madrox, the Multiple Man, gets shot.
Yeah,
and presumably dies, but. Again, he's the Multiple Man, so it's only one of his multiples.
Right.
That's the running story for the next few issues, is somebody's picking off Madrox's. Hmm. But it was, like I said, it was a fun book. And the thing that stuck out for me was that it was all new. It was all different. It did feel unique. And the costumes, this helped create like a lot of the 90s stereotypes, at least on the cover, because of just the, you know, you got the Havoc there has got the face mask thing that, or like the spandex on his head, but still lets his hair, yeah, the coif stick out.
It's like a half cowl or something.
Yeah. You know, they got leather, they got straps, they got these giant boots that, you know, it's all so excessive and unnecessary and bulky and dumb, ultimately, in hindsight.
But I'm sure it's all very practical. If you were in an actual fight, it would probably work flawlessly and exactly how you want it to.
Not even a little bit, but man, my 12-year-old brain was immediately hooked, and I bought into all of it, and I did stupid drawings of my own stupid characters wearing derivative costumes that were inspired by this, and yeah.
Well, this is the blue and gold kickoff of the X-Men and the whole X-Universe, wasn't it?
This actually came out right after X-Men number one.
Okay.
X-Men number one came out in August of 91. This came out in October of 91. So okay. 2 months apart. So yeah, I mean, it was that same era of, yeah, the blue and gold.
Yes. And man, I tell you what, X-Men, Marvel was having a lot of financial trouble at this time, but X-Men kept them afloat.
Yeah. Because
the whole X-Universe was huge. Everybody loved the whole X-Universe, X-Men type and X-Men adjacent books.
Yeah. Yeah, and at that time, you're right, they could have slapped the letter X on anything and it would have sold regardless of the content. But
yep.
And the nice thing about this is they didn't just kill X-Factor. It wasn't an afterthought. They did put some thought into the direction that this was going to go to make it different than the other X-Men books, which were still just your standard X-Men books of running around fighting Magneto.
Yeah. That's a good idea, though. I didn't realize that they'd pulled these obscure characters, you know, from the vault and let's put them in the X-Factor and give them their own story and give them their own universe to kind of play in.
Yeah. Yeah. Then,
you know,
go ahead.
I was going to say, in just a fun twist of irony, I remember seeing like X Factor and X Force books on the shelf and going, oh, so just a ripoff of X Men? I'll just go over here and read my Newman book because it's a new and original.
This is all new and all different.
Right, yeah.
And the good thing about this, Al, is if they would have done this today, it would have been a number one, but they didn't.
Yeah.
They're like, nah, we're just going to issue 71. Right. We're going to kind of switch. We're going to pivot.
Right. Yeah. They didn't relaunch and destroy any legacy numbering or anything.
Nope.
But yeah, you're right. Nowadays, there's no legacy numbering. It's number one because that's going to sell.
Yeah, exactly. So this is in the time when they're like, we don't need number ones. It's not that big a deal. We're just going to pivot and go with a different story, and we're not going to change the numbering, you know?
Well, and it was also, I think, more respect for the fans because, you know, some of us were here for X Factor.
Did they have any crossover characters from the old to the new? I mean, obviously this was Cyclops and some of the others. I saw there was Cyclops was in
well,
here.
Yeah,
but...
well, in this issue, you had Cyclops and Professor X who were coming in to kind of help sell Havoc on the idea, and you know,
okay.
Otherwise, this is it. And it was like this for a couple years with this team, and they didn't bring. There, it wasn't like every fourth issue. Here's Wolverine to help move numbers.
Yeah.
These guys stood on their own.
Nice, I like that. That's a good idea. Let's just stay with what works.
Right. Well, I was going to say that speaks to the story and the dedication, though, of the fans, too, that they didn't need to do a gimmick of, like you said, like, oh, our sales are low, so throw Wolverine in the next issue. It's like, no, this book is doing fine. We don't need a gimmick or any more gimmicks, I should say, to keep it going.
Well, and they were lucky, too, because they had really good artists like Larry Stroman. He'd been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And he's got a very unique style and it's very graphic. And they had him he was on this book for just under a year. And then he went off, ironically, to Image to do his own book. And then after replacing him was Joe Quesada, who was on this book just over a year until he went off to Image.
I'm sensing a pattern here.
Yeah, there's a weird theme I'm feeling here.
Yeah.
He's a good artist. Yeah, this is very, so we were looking at Youngblood before this, and you can tell the difference. Different style. They make the panels seems to be a lot smaller.
And it's very graphic. It's,
yeah.
Well, and it's actually broken down like into panels as opposed to, like looking at like Youngblood and even the Newman, like the other Image stuff where, like Al said, like there's a big dramatic like splash of character or characters and then maybe a small panel or two at the bottom, where this is like, nope, we got panel, next page.
Yeah.
More traditional, I should say.
But at the same time, it's also very dynamic and really captures the eye.
It does.
Right, yeah.
Fun to look at.
Yeah, it's not static or flat compared to the other ones, but just it's a very different layout.
Yeah, you can just see the difference between the two. It's not good or bad. I was just kind of noticing the dichotomy between the two. It's very, very different style. But this is very, very traditional of what it was in the early 90s for Marvel.
Yeah.
So
it was certainly following the formula.
It was. And it was working. So
Don't fix it if it's not broke, right?
Exactly. I like that theory. Let's just take our old characters and put them in a book and let them have some fun and get some mileage out of this if we can. So, all right. Well, Ben, what's your next one?
We got ourselves, sticking with Image here, Wetworks, was, again, 90s. I think came out like June of 94. Four-ish was the first issue. It actually got a couple of different releases throughout its run. That's why, like on this one, you can see at the top, and even the copy that I have, it says Rebirth across the top. Mm-hmm. But this was originally done by, what did we say his name? Willis Portacio?
Willis Portacio, yeah.
There it is, what Al said. Yes. And Brandon Choi was the writer.
Yep.
It only ran for 4 years. And then it got tried to get relaunched in the early 2000s, but it only worked for a little bit after that.
Over three years, wasn't there only like three issues?
It was something really weird. There's more than three issues, but not much. I think it made it to 10 or 12, and then it kind of got revamped and new creative team, and then it didn't really go well there after that. But this is Wet Works, as the name implies, is a covert ops mercenary that, you know, they kick ass and take names. It was actually, the wormholes and rabbit holes you can go down when researching this stuff. So the team in here is referenced as Team 7, which was from another book that had different characters, except for one, Jackson Dane, who's the leader. He was on the original Team 7, and then they brought him over as still the leader of Team 7 in Wet Works. But like the history of these characters and how they got to Wet Works is, for it being an original book, it's like, oh, well, this guy was actually over here, and this concept came from here. It was really convoluted. We ended up with the Wet Works here. They start out as regular old, like I said, mercenaries. Think of a Predator type team that goes in, like I said, kicks ass, takes names. It opens on this mission that they got sent on to clear out a pack of terrorists. As they get there, they're doing their fighting and whatnot. They find these tubes with this weird gold liquid in it. As they're investigating and figuring out what to do and getting orders from their higher up, the terrorists come back and start fighting them. One of them shoots one of the containers, and the gold liquid sprays out on one of the characters. The first one that gets infected, if you want to say it, was his name was Claymore. That was his call sign. Really original. His real name is Clayton Maurer. And so they called him Claymore. But he gets coated in that gold liquid, which is a symbiote of some sort. It completely covers him. As the terrorists keep fighting and shooting him, the rest of the team notices the bullets are just bouncing on him. He's not getting hurt. They're pinned down. They're probably not going to win. Of course, somewhere along the line, an explosive has been triggered. God knows how that happened. So their fearless leader, true 90s Ando style, orders them, break open the rest of the tubes and put this gold crap that we have no idea what is all over yourself, because it seems to be able to help.
That's how class
acts. They fight off the terrorists. They fight off the terrorists, big explosion, and they come out, you know, covered in the gold stuff, unharmed. But they realize that they've been double-crossed by their higher-ups. And one of the characters, her name is Mother One. She's a cyborg. She's the one who informs them that they've been double-crossed and recruits them to work for who she actually works for. Again, remember, convoluted. And out of nowhere, now they're recruited to be a covert team that fights werewolves and vampires.
Nice. They've got that
monster
vibe.
Right. And I remember, you know, you guys have said it a couple times with the storylines of these books from the 90s, just like going off the rails. This one, I bought every issue when it came out. I had a pull list at my comic shop, so I knew I never missed an issue. But it just seemed like, as I'm reading, just like out of the blue, they're fighting werewolves. And I'm just like, where the hell did werewolves come from? Like, I went back and reread like the first three issues to see, like, did I miss the introduction of werewolves? And I kind of did, but not really.
Yeah.
Like, it was like a throwaway kind of almost line, not really line, but they kind of mentioned them. But then all of a sudden they're the main bad guy.
It is. Yeah. Vampires and werewolves. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really kind of weird how it came in. This again was the main reason I got into it. This one, I'll freely admit, my brother and his friends got into it, and I read the first issue. I stole my brother's first issue and read it, and I was just like, oh, this is cool. So I decided that this is going to be my new book as well. I did like the story when it started out. The artwork really stuck out to me, at least the cover art.
Yeah.
And I think that's still to this day where when it comes to like even like with our Omug stuff and anything else, it cover art obviously is what draws you in. But what really frustrates me is when I see an awesome cover and then I open up the book and like the art doesn't match.
Yeah.
And the thing with these image books, at least like Wetworks, to me, you saw the cover, it was big and bold and crazy. But as you looked into the book and opened it up and flipped through pages, it matched. Like they didn't spend all their money on the cover and then kind of half-ass the stuff inside. That's great that you have that because
it's got the triple. Yeah, there you go. It's the triple fold-out cover, which was very common in the 90s. But yeah,
yes.
But you're right, Ben. You're right. Image was
so
notorious for having amazing covers, but the artwork was almost the same inside.
Yeah, and I remember this one, and I still feel that way looking at this. Like, looking at the characters, looking at the Image logo there in the bottom corner, you know, they're supposed to be covered in this, like, liquid gold, liquid metal. And when I looked at the cover and looked through the book, I felt like I was looking at liquid gold and liquid metal on the page. It wasn't just colored a gold color. Like, it's like you somehow made this actually look like metal.
Yeah.
And so that just really hooked me and kept me going. And you know, I probably stuck with it for the first half of the run. I never got any of the ones. In fact, I didn't even really know that they relaunched it in the early 2000s until I started researching it again. So I never read any of those, but I read pretty much the entire first run from 94 to 98. And I was looking at this issue that I had to rebuy a while ago. And I know we joke that, you know, the 90s comics are not a good investment. However, if you see, it was $1.95 originally.
Yep.
And I bought it for like $3.
Wow.
So
hey,
if I had my original, I would have made myself $1.05.
That's some serious appreciation.
Right. So, you know, if I had like 10 or 12 million of those, I'd be set.
Yeah.
No, but I even kind of flipped through this again as I was prepping for this and taking my notes. The artwork still, I still love the artwork. It still looks amazing. The story, it's still a story that I like. They may not have told it the best, or maybe it doesn't hold up that well, but just the concept, I've always liked, you know, again, 80s, 90s action type. We just have a group of extreme badasses that magically are all on one team, and then we found a way to make them even more badass.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Oh, you're exactly
I still, right. To this day, like it.
Predator. You take the cast of Predator and dip them in liquid gold.
Pretty much what they did. Yes.
Yeah.
So much so that, yeah, there's even, there's a, again, a Native American guy who has, you know, I'm sure like a totally culturally appropriate name. like his name's not like, you know, Dustwalker or anything like that. It is.
Is there dialogue in there about how much time they have to bleed?
Probably. I mean, if I look through it again, there probably is. I think there's a guy with a minigun even.
Of course.
There is. He's got like the chain gun.
It's huge pecs and huge muscles and huge guns and
And this is another like looking through the names of guys or of the people on this team, I think that also is what, you know, draws me in and keeps me going. Cause that's one thing about comic books and like G.I. Joe. I've always loved how they come up with the names and how they fit in with, or one way or the other, how they fit them in with the character. Like the original, I'll just run them through real quick. The original members of the team were Claymore, Crossbones, Dane, who's not very creative because his name is Jackson Dane, Dozer, Flat Top, Grail, Jester, Mother One, Pilgrim, and Blackbird. Yeah. I bet you can't guess which one's the Native American.
Yeah. It's like, which one is not like the others?
Was it Dane?
Got it. Yep. Colonel Jackson Dane.
Dane. That was Dane, wasn't it? Yeah.
It just overall, again, the main thing, I'm very visual. It was all the artwork, all the coolness of that is what drew me in and kept me going. But then again, like I said, the story itself, or at least the concept of the story, I will always, you know, I'll watch any movie or comic book that kind of follows that premise for the most part.
Oh, this is one I saw, Ben, in a comic book catalog to buy in, I think, late 92. And I ordered it. And then it said, oh, it's on back issue, or, you know, back log. And then I ordered it again 6 months later. Oh, sorry, it's delayed again. I think I ordered it. It took three times for me to finally get it.
That, though, had nothing to do with Rob Liefeld.
I know.
Actually, what happened there is it was originally slated to come out in 92 as part of the core Image launch, when they were going to launch the label and all their flagship books. But Portacio's sister died. And so they had to delay it until 94. And actually, Jim Lee's Wildstorm was the original publisher that pushed for part of Image. They always reference it as an imprint, so I'm assuming that just means while Jim Lee worked with Image, he had his, you know, Liefeld had Extreme Studios.
Sure.
Lee had Wildstorm.
Wildstorm. Yep.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, it was highly touted. It was muchly anticipated, Wetworks. That was what I kept seeing in all the catalogs and Wizard magazine talking about it. It was highly, highly anticipated.
Yeah, and I would like to think, I mean, you know, obviously you can't control the death of a family member, but I'd like to think if it came out in 92 as part of the core Image mothership books, that it probably would have done a little bit better than, like I said, the 10 or 15 issue run that it did do in those 4 years.
It, I think it hurt it with that, the waiting. It got anticipated too much, so the hype might have hurt expectation. There we go.
Yeah.
Did you have this one, Al?
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. I figured you probably did.
Yep.
And this was another one I always love, you know, when I talk about comics with people, and I still to this day think that I'm like, you know, I'm like, I got some underground book, you know, like, oh, I'm into Wetworks. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, I remember that. It's like, oh.
Okay. Well, it was, you had, especially the original seven, the original seven Image books, you had to get all the number ones. You mm-hmm. just, because they were going to get you retirement and put you through college someday.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Oh, I looked it up, Ben, on according to Wikipedia, it had 43 issues on their first run.
Was it?
Yeah, and then 15 on the second run that they tried to
do. That's what it was. The second run was only like 15.
Yeah. So, interesting.
Yeah, it's again, I mean, they made some trades out of it too. And again, it's like I said, even to this day, when I pick it up, I still love the artwork and it draws me in. In fact, like I said, the copy that I have here, I went back through probably 7 or 8 years ago and decided I wanted to buy comic books again. But I rebought the first, you know, few runs of, but first few issues of Wetworks. Into some stuff that I'd read in the past before, instead of trying to come up or trying to start with something new, because I didn't want to jump in the middle of some like million number run here. So it's like, I'll just reread Wetworks.
Yeah. No, it's a very iconic cover. It's very smooth. He does a good job of, really colorizing it. And just, I mean, it's typical 90s. He's got abs there. You can see, but,
right. He's got like a nine pack.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. The whole idea of what he came up with was kind of a cool.
We're starting to see some of the pouches that Youngblood was missing.
Yeah. More guns.
Yes.
Yeah. Fun book. All right. So last one here for me was Death of Superman. This one, like we talked about at the beginning, was a massive, massive hit. Iconic cover and of Superman taking on Doomsday. They were lagging a little bit in sales, DC was, on Superman, and they were trying to coordinate with, if you remember the TV show, The Adventures of Lois and Clark on ABC. So they were going to do a wedding episode or a wedding run, I guess. DC Comics was trying to get it to coordinate with the comic book, but it wasn't lining up right. So they needed something to boost sales between the start of the TV show until they got to the wedding. And so they came up with Dan Jurgens, who came up with this idea of, well, why don't we kill off Superman? And it took off like wildfire. It sold like crazy. Even mainstream media got into it. So I think I got a note here where CNN was talking about it. Saturday Night Live did a skit on it. The Washington Post, Newsweek, all sorts of mainstream media was talking about this, which was something we don't understand that nowadays because, you know, comic books and comic book characters are everywhere. But back then, this '90s, it was starting to wane a little bit as far as being a little bit, what would you say, unpopular to wear. If you wore an X-Men T-shirt on the playground in 1989, you'd probably get beat up.
Yeah, you were getting made fun of.
Yeah. Now? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just common day. So right. Again, this sounds kind of weird. Like, well, of course they're talking about it. It's like, no, mainstream media did not talk about comic books very often. It was rare.
Well, but Superman, though, he was always the outlier to that, just because he was the superhero. You could wear a Superman shirt with just the insignia anytime, and you're going to be all right.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was still, this was a huge cultural, just a huge event.
Right.
It was.
Well, yeah. Like Lee said, I remember seeing this like on the nightly news, like almost every night, how they kept, you know, saying, oh, yep, it's official. They're killing off Superman. We don't have any details, but the book's coming. I remember that. And then thinking to myself, oh, my gosh, Superman, what are they going to do if they kill off Superman? They can't do that. Which, as we learn in comic books, when you die, you're not really dead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the mainstream media kind of not knowing about comic books, how nobody's actually dead. It was like, oh my gosh, this is, what are they going to do? And, you know, as us comic book fans, they're like, well, we know he's not going to be dead for very long. Now, the plan was to keep him dead for a lot longer than what they did, but sales dropped so much that they're, oh crap, we got to bring him back and we got to do it sooner rather than later.
Right.
But it was a huge event. Dan Jurgens at the time was kind of just a mid-level artist writer at the time, but this obviously catapulted him to fame by killing off Superman, and he did the artwork and the story for a lot of it. So, like I said, you got Doomsday coming from another planet. It was Krypton, ancient Krypton, that they did genetic studies on this creature and had him resurrected and send him out on this planet, and he would get killed. They'd grab the DNA, recirculate it, grow him in a vat, and send him back out on the planet, and then he would die, and just until he became this ultimate being. And so they needed somebody big and bad. That's what Dan Jurgens said. It said that Superman's villains they can't go toe to toe with him necessarily. The villains are trying to outsmart him, like Lex Luthor. I want a character that can go toe-to-toe with Superman and take him down. And so that's where he came up with the character of Doomsday. So really good story. I liked it. And just because it was so mainstream, it had the patches you could buy that had the black patch with the Superman logo on it in red that you could wear in honor of the death of Superman. So it was just a fun story. They circled in a lot of characters, the old Justice League and other characters that they brought in to try to take down Doomsday, but ultimately they needed Superman to do it. So, but that the cover with the Superman on the cover dead with the black blood, you know, because they had to still adhere to the Comics Code Authority, so they couldn't have red blood, so they made it black. I just remember seeing that, like, why don't they just put red on there? Well, you know, we know he's, but later on they reprinted it and they did make the blood red for that cover where Lois Lane is holding Superman.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, so what about you guys? You guys probably had this or got this, right? Or
I don't know.
Okay.
So I wasn't a DC fan at the time.
I wasn't really either, but this just captured my attention.
Yeah. I knew of this, and I have a book, because DC was doing the same thing. They took a page out of Marvel's playbook that Marvel did with X-Force and with Spider-Man, where they sent it out pre-polybagged.
Ah.
So they sent out, when these would hit the newsstands, they had the white poly bag with the Superman logo, but you can't see what's inside there. Like, you were just,
yes, I remember that.
Like, you just knew if you were buying the book every month, this is the next one. And so in my collection, I have a white poly bag Superman book. I have no idea what it is.
Oh,
what?
Fun.
I don't know. I have no idea. I know that it's from the Death of Superman series, but I have no idea
which one.
Nope.
You could be sitting on your retirement, Al.
I know. They also had some black poly bags with a Superman logo in this series, but no, I don't know what I have, but I do, you know, I remember this, and I think I read some trades of it.
Yeah.
Some point, and you know, everybody knew the story, and I knew my friend's brother, actually, he was into DC, so I'd read his issues, especially when they brought out all of the Supermen.
Yep.
As a result of him dying, which
yep
was just unbelievably 90s.
Yes, there you go. Cyborg Superman, Steel, and
the Mullet Superman, and
the Mullet. There was
an Alien, Cyborg, Steel, Superboy.
Okay, that's what they did.
And then the Mullet Superman, I think, is the one that ended up being the real quote unquote Superman.
The real one. Yeah,
Mullet Superman was. He was the one that came out in the black, I believe, at the first, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, and he killed Cyborg Superman by punching him through the back.
Yeah, and everybody else, what was fun, I thought, was the other Superman all stuck around. Like Steel became his own character. The leather Superman became, you know, he stuck around. And they were good designs. They were fun, new, fresh designs of Superman. So,
it's funny how readers wanted something different, but when they got rid of him, they wanted him back.
So, Lee, as you're flipping through here on the screen, one thing you'll notice is as they were building up to the end, so it was like four issues is what culminated.
Yep.
Well, in these images, if you notice, so in the one issue that was fourth away from the end, every page has four panels. The next issue, every page has three panels. So I can tell by looking at this that this is the issue right before the final one where he dies, because every page has two panels.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
In the last issue, when he actually dies, it's just every page is just black.
One page.
Well, yep. Try to find that here. Good catch, Al.
I did not catch that. I saw that on something else that I saw.
Okay.
That and pointed that out to me. But yeah.
Yep, you're right. So the last issue here, it's all one page.
The crazy thing about this,
that's crazy. Is
from a design standpoint and a storytelling standpoint, you have to be very, very confident and very, very particular about how you're telling your story. Because as opposed to a normal comic book where you can get 100 images in to tell the story, you've only got 24 images to tell the story of Superman getting killed here.
Wow. That's a good point.
Crazy.
Here's the iconic punch each other and they both die. But yeah, I didn't notice that till you pointed it out. Oh, I'm going to flip back real quick. And so if you go back, well, even when you start, like you said, when you start shrinking it down. So if you're just doing two panels, but you're right. Yeah. By the time you get down to one panel, holy cow.
Yeah. You have to be very sure of what that image is going to be.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
But also conversely, you've also got the benefit of you've had three other books to more or less tell the story. So there's not as much story to tell.
Right.
But you still have to plan and think about and, you know, because you don't get as much. Like you said, even on two panels, that would be 48 images to try to tell the story.
Right.
So that's crazy.
Or I guess you could have the inverse. If you have four panels, now you have to figure out, how am I going to expound on the story with four or five panels? You know.
Yeah, I mean, DC really threw everything they had at this, you know, with this gimmick, so to speak, or concept. You know, and also, what's his name? The bad guy.
Doomsday.
Doomsday, his costume is getting more and more shredded as you go along.
Yep, he starts out completely covered, then by the end, finally, the big reveal.
Yeah. You know, but yeah, with the polybagging and this and everything, you know, really they were only missing like hologram covers. The only gimmick that they didn't use.
Right.
That was coming. This came out in December of 92, by the way. So this was, the hologram covers were coming just around the corner.
Was December of 92 when...
This was also...
It came out, let's see, it ran from December of 92 until October of 93.
Okay.
So they finally killed him off.
Was the death of Superman the first time like a big name character was killed off?
Yeah.
At
this level, they had Superman pretended to be dead. He turned into a ghost to take out one of the villains. But yeah, this is the first time they'd kind of officially killed off Superman.
Yeah.
Because then it was after this, because DC was getting crushed in all the numbers before this. Even, you know, in the late 80s, even before the 90s boom, DC's numbers weren't good.
No.
Batman was riding high from, was still riding the wave that Frank Miller started with the Dark Knight Returns. Mm-hmm. And was still right. The best. Superman was lagging way behind.
Yeah.
This boosted a lot. And then after this, they did Nightfall.
Yes.
Where Batman had his back broken.
Yes. So, yes, this right. triggered Nightfall, and then this triggered Emerald Twilight with Green Lantern.
Yeah.
So that's where all of this – so they came up with this major arcs of killing off characters or severely injuring characters like Batman. So
right.
I give a lot of credit to DC because they're sitting there watching what Marvel's doing and what Image is doing, yeah. and they're thinking, oh, man, we got to do something.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do? What could they had nothing that they could have done that could have been bigger than this.
No. And it kicked off a lot of – I was reading some articles about it, and a lot of people got into comics because of this, because yeah. of the mainstream coverage and – people are like, well, I've kind of heard of Superman. I've seen the movies, but I really don't know a whole lot about it. And a lot of people picked up Death of Superman and then boom, got into. And so again, DC worked their magic and it did what it needed to do. Got people in.
Yeah. I like to think that when they pitched this in a boardroom, there's one guy who like, maybe we should scale it back a notch, not kill off Superman. You know, let's save that one for a little bit later. Let's not, you know, shoot our whole load in one.
Right.
And then they outvoted him. They went with it. And then, you know, their numbers started to dip again and they're having another meeting trying to figure out what to do to get their numbers up. And that same guy who voted against it was like, oh, I don't know. Maybe we could kill off Superman. Oh, wait, we already did that.
Come on.
Why don't we just maim Wonder Woman or something?
Yeah. Yeah. Right? No kidding. Lose an arm or something. I don't know. Come on. She doesn't need both of those.
Well, actually, they did turn in around this time is when they turned Wonder Woman into the biker costume.
Really?
Yeah, they put her in all the leather and the skimpiness and stuff.
Oh man! So they're grasping for straws here.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, death, and like death, I said, that guy's just sitting in the corner going, "Man, I wish we had a big bombshell we could do like killing Superman." but we did that years ago.
Yeah, Dan Jurgens is the one that came up with this because they had a meeting just like Ben was talking about and like, what are we going to do? Sales are lagging. We want to lead up to this wedding to coordinate with the TV show, but that's a couple years away. What are we going to do? And that's what he came up with was let's kill him off and introduce a new villain and get rid of him.
You could safely say that this definitely got eyeballs on the TV show.
Oh, yeah, definitely. No doubt about it. So it worked both ways, I guess.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, that's the last one I got. So I think that's all of our picks for this go around. So we're planning on doing this on a semi-regular basis. We'll kind of playing with the idea here and we'll kind of work out some of the bugs, but I like it. I think it's fun to go back and visit some of these early 90s comics and covers and just comics just was becoming over the top almost in some ways. But again, like we all said, the theme I think is we all bought into it.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. Say all those execs knew exactly what they were doing, which I guess is why they were, you know, they had been the CEOs for a reason. So
that's right.
And we loved every bit of it. You know, we kind of make fun of the foil 3D covers, but we all bought them and we loved them.
Yeah. I can bust those out for the next episode.
Yeah. Yeah. So stick around. We're gonna do this on a regular basis, and we'll maybe look at covers or just insane spreads.
Variant covers can be our next issue or next covers. Episode,
or just the splash. I remember showing my son. I don't know if you remember X from Dark Horse Comics, but there was an internal panel where it's just explosions in the background, and he's got this gritty cape on. As he's like, that just screams early 90s. I'm like, yeah, it does. you're exactly right. I'm like, it's funny when kids, you're like, wow, that just looks just like when you guys grew up. And I'm like, yeah, it kind of does. So maybe we'll toss around different ideas.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll put a pin in this, guys. Thanks for jumping in. I really appreciate it. And I'll put links in the show notes for OMUG Comics and how you can get your hold of Al and Ben. And let us know what you think. If you like what we picked, or if you're like, I disagree with you guys. I think they stunk. You know, whatever. we'll roll with it. So, all right. Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. We'll see you again next time.
Thank you.